And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and you can catch us on the web, taylor-report.com, and write to us, taylor@CIUT.FM. And here with me in the studio is Phil Conlon. How are you doing there, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to be talking to a journalist, Mahdi Nazimroya, who was in Tripoli when the bombing was taking place, July and August, and frankly, narrowly escaped with his life, along with other journalists. And so we're going to ask him about his experiences, what he makes of the current developments, the ongoing bombing, the ongoing NATO bombing of Libya. If you want to know about that, go to StopNATO.com. Rick Rozoff, every day he updates you on the number of missions flown and the number of strikes made by NATO. You remember they euphemistically called their bombing zone the no-fly zone. There's a no-fly zone for anybody but the bombers, which is how you bring peace and freedom and social advancement to people. Just check out the career of General Custer, and you'll have a rough idea. And later in the show, Phil, you're going to tell us about attending the International Film Festival.
The Toronto International Film Festival ended yesterday, and with some bad films and some good, and I want to talk about some of the good ones.
Yeah. Well, you're the authority. I mean, you've actually, we ought to probably review how many you've attended, but I know that you ought to be writing a kind of commentary on this because it's one of the great film festivals.
Well, and certainly the idea is that the films are the literature of the 21st century and can do good and can do bad. And
I
saw a little of each, yes.
By the way, you have a cast iron stomach. You tell me, before the show, you were telling me about some of these films, and we'll get into it later, but I don't know if I could sit through all those. I always admired H.L. Mencken's comment he made. He said he had attended movies. He thought maybe he had seen three to their completion, but he didn't see any need to watch things he didn't like. Actually, now the big question is, what did H.L. Mencken like? He saw three films to the end?
I'd love to know what those three are.
Yeah. Let me tell you again who we're going to be talking to today, Mahdi Nazimroya. And he's with Global Research. I don't know if you know globalresearch.ca, but they have been very, very sharp in their coverage. They're not called global for nothing. They do cover the entire world. And since this war is coming to some kind of bloody chapter, we don't know if it's the end of the story, but we've certainly had a chapter. You need to be going to Global Research and other sites, such as the Monthly Review site, MRZINE.com. These are journals and writers like Rick Rozoff, Stop NATO. We need to talk, by the way, in the second half, we will discuss a little bit Canada, NATO, and the phenomenon called NORAD, because there's an anniversary of that discussion. We are joined now, I believe, by Mahdi Nazimroya. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Hey, Mahdi, first of all, let me just congratulate you on you probably don't like such language, but a quite heroic effort to be a journalist in Tripoli in the months of July, August of this year. And you must have, let's just start with the sound. You were there when the bombs were falling, and that must be very challenging just to sit still under bombardment.
Well, it can be, it can affect one's nerves for sure, especially when the bombs are very close. And there were times where I was driving from point A to point B where explosions were very close. And many a night I woke up because of explosions or the shaking affected the very hotel I was in. And I was off the top of my head, I think on the sixth or seventh floor. And the hotel would shake all the way up there. So it was very nerve-wracking. But the people who actually lived in the residential areas, those are really brave people because they lived through those bombings.
Yeah, and of course they're living through the military aftershock of the experience here in Tripoli. It seems like a very important moment occurred with the amphibious assault with air cover of Misrata. Was that sort of the decisive moment in terms of your presence in Tripoli and also the fate of the city of Tripoli?
Well, the air assault was, there was multiple air assaults, and I think there was many critical points. I think the most critical point of all was when the Western Mountains, one of the commanders in the Western Mountains left, and the bombings in Tripoli increased. They actually saturated the place with bombs. I use the term carpet bombing. Mm-hmm. They've been carpet bombing. That's what I usually tell people. Mm-hmm. It's not an accurate military description, but I think a saturated military description is very accurate.
Yeah. Well, certainly, in order to advance ashore, I mean, I was trained in the U.S. Marines years ago. I know that we're always told you're going to have so much air cover that you're going to come in, get out of the boat, and make your way to the beach. And because of the air cover, I mean, and who can resist that kind of superiority if they're trying to stand off an amphibious assault? It can't be done.
Well, for sure. The amphibious assault would not be impossible without the bomb. That is a fact. The rebels could not have entered Tripoli by themselves. It was the air assault. It was the turning point, as well as the psychological war.
Yeah, and apropos of that, you point out in various reports, and I've seen you being interviewed, and you have said that the rebels are at this moment once again trying to capture areas such as Sirte, and you would know the names of the others better than I. But
Bani Walid, for example, mm-hmm. where the spokesman of the Libyan government is fighting right now.
Yeah.
He's more than just a spokesman now; he's fighting for his life.
But those rebels, as you point out, they're not that capable. Once again, they've been beaten off over the weekend. Am I right?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat that question.
Yeah,
I
speak too fast. The rebels actually have shown again that they are incapable, actually, without just, you know, a heavy NATO involvement of accomplishing anything significant as an army, right?
That is absolutely correct. That is right on the bullseye. They are incapable. They were incapable of coming into Tripoli. They showed they're incapable of going into the small urban area of Bani Walid, and they actually started fighting each other. Mm-hmm. They're not a homogeneous fighting force at all. They fight each other. They started fighting each other in Tripoli, near the Corinthian Hotel, in the Radisson, Blue. They started fighting themselves in these places. Even in Benghazi, they've been fighting each other. And the media and the networks that support them have even reported this. No, they are not a cohesive military force whatsoever. It's NATO that's done all the heavy work. It's NATO that's bombed whole areas into rubble. It's NATO that attacked all the security checkpoints and cleared the way for them. So mm-hmm. it was NATO that did all the heavy work for them.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya. You can find his articles and interviews at globalresearch.ca. And Global Research has been doing a fantastic job. You mentioned this matter of they're fighting each other, and I noticed in your interview there was this phenomenon in the mountains where apparently a commander was co-opted, which led to the disaster in terms of, you know, the defense of the city. That actually is not a widely known story. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I know about that because Gaddafi's grandnephew briefed me on the situation. I was very critical of his family, of course, specifically Gaddafi's children, Saif al-Islam, for starters.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very frank with him about this. And we built a relationship of trust. Him and his family, I'm speaking about his grandnephew, they fought in the streets. They fought like regular people. They were not commanders or anything like that of the sort. But he briefed me on the situation in the Western Mountains, and it was the commander who defected was actually one of Gaddafi's relatives as well. He told his forces to leave. They left the highway there. And when they left the highway, they opened the road towards Sirmon and Zawiya on the Mediterranean, western Mediterranean coast of Libya. And that's how about a few hundred, maximum 200, 200, 150 fighters went into these areas. And Al Jazeera was embedded with them. And they got pushed back, and Al Jazeera was actually pushed back into the mountains. But this was how things spiraled. It caused psychological damage, and a lot of people in Tripoli became afraid. And the media started making all sorts of fictitious reports. And put together with the bombing, the fictitious reports about an imminent collapse, a lot of people started defecting then. At the same time, the Prime Minister of Libya, Prime Minister Baghdadi, was secretly negotiating for defections along with others. One of the Achilles heels of the Libyan Arab Jamhuriya and its government was the fact that there was no streamlined route for negotiation. There was different people negotiating with different interests. So this was part of their downfall. And a lot of people who were looking out for themselves or who had no interest in regards to the people defected, and fear caused defection or people to stay at home. But they're still fighting. I still want to point out the government hasn't collapsed. They're still fighting. There's a counteroffensive that has started a few days ago, maybe over a week ago, which has been strong. The Libyan military right now is near Beni Walid, strategically placed, and it has the high ground.
Mm-hmm.
And they are still fighting. And the media wants us to think that the Libyan government's collapsed. In fact, before they came into Tripoli, there was announcements that the Libyan government had collapsed, which was not true. It was made in anticipation, and it was made to also fuel the psychological war and the misinformation about
mm-hmm.
Libya.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I mean that, and again, global research is quite good on this point. There is not only information and news outlets, but there is some pretty sophisticated disinformation. You know, where false announcements where Gaddafi has fled was an outstanding one. I remember you recall the first days. And those things can be very disquieting and demoralizing to a population. And it's very hard because I think also you point out in your report that they bombed to destroy Libyan communications so they could not have the capacity to correct false information.
Yes, they bombed Libyan telecommunications. And they bombed all the Libyan broadcasting network facilities. They bombed them, and it was strategic bombardment. It was to keep them from reporting what was actually happening on the ground. They were targeting Libyan journalists against international law, and very few voices said anything about this when they were bombing Libyan broadcasting authority sites. And they did it till the day they attacked Tripoli. They were doing this.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of stories that are not reported and are a criminal, by the way, it is a crime, isn't it, according to the Geneva Conventions, to bomb communications, radios and television?
It is a crime to bomb. First of all, it's a crime to bomb civilian infrastructure that has nothing to do with combat.
CAUT would not like to be bombed, I can tell you.
Of course. it's the equivalent of bombing the BBC or the CBC. Or CNN. Imagine what people would say if this was the other way around.
Crime would be the first word, I think.
their pretext or their justification for doing this was they had to stop the Gaddafi propaganda. That's what they say, to save human lives.
So the person saying that was, of course, the head of the propaganda department, right?
What if the Libyans said, let us kill CNN reporters or BBC reporters or Al Jazeera reporters to stop the lies that are killing Libyans? What if they did it? What if they turned that rationale around? No one would accept that. What happened there is criminal. Yeah. It is criminal, and they've been lying since the start. They lied about cities that fell that never fell. They lied about the pretext for the war. They lied about Gaddafi leaving, like you said, to Venezuela to cause panic at the very beginning. They lied about his son dying. One of his sons has died over 6 times. I guess this guy is
he got three more lives to go.
Yes, he's an immortal, I guess. 6 times he's died.
Yeah, maybe we should find out what he's made of and try to join, I guess. We're speaking to Mahdi Nazimroya, a very brave reporter, and thank goodness you were there because disinformation was... rife here. It's quite difficult to get stories. I went to globalresearch.ca in order to follow your voice and to get something resembling, even if a fresh point of view. Now, there is a shocking story that has appeared in the Wall Street Journal only in the last couple of days, and they had previously written about this subject, and that is the massacre of Africans and African Libyans. And in a particularly the town near Misrata, can you talk about that, what you know about that? I think the town is called Towerga. Is that right?
Yes, you got it. That place has been turned into a ghost town.
It's been turned into
a ghost town, and they've been mercilessly killing people, lynching them. In fact, let me tell you, on their way to attack CERT, they ripped out all the billboards with pan-African leaders. Gamal Abdel Nasser was also on that, but every African leader whose picture was on there, I believe Nelson Mandela included, they ripped them off.
They ripped off the photo of Nasser?
Yes, Gamal Abdel Nasser was there, but he's an African leader after all.
He certainly was, but also I just want to make sure the Egyptians hear about this.
No, they did. There's a picture taken of that, and it shows them ripping all the pictures of these African leaders. These are resistance leaders, leaders of liberation movements. When we say, I want to emphasize, Libyans are all Africans, regardless of their skin color or whatever. Their continent's Africa. Mm-hmm. There's dark-skinned Libyans, black-skinned, whatever that could mean. It's subjective, but black-skinned, brown-skinned, white-skinned. A Libyan can be blonde with blue eyes and look Scandinavian. They can have a Mediterranean complexion and look like they're from Saudi Arabia or Italy or Lebanon or Iran. Mm-hmm. Or they could be dark-skinned, very dark-skinned, and look like they're from Pakistan. Or they can look like they're from Somalia, Sudan, Ghana, somewhere in West Africa. Mm-hmm. Many mixed looks in that country. And what they did is, because of the media lies that there's so-called African mercenaries, which means black-skinned people.
Yes.
They started attacking the Libyans with black skin. So the media here, in league with some of the rebels on the ground, created this myth. And as a consequence, they're attacking black-skinned people, and they're attacking foreign African migrant workers there. But not only that, they're attacking Asian migrant workers and European migrant workers. Right now, not only are African migrant workers being targeted, but so are people from Eastern Europe and the Slavic countries, such as Serbia, Bosnia, Bulgaria, Belarus, Ukraine, Russia. These people are also being targeted, and I believe some were hung in Benghazi just today or a few days ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's particularly, as you really outlined it very nicely, this is a tragic construction which they have created, which will lead to the deaths of hundreds and hundreds of people. And I noticed, I saw this in the Black Star News, but the Black Star News is citing the Wall Street Journal and they witnessed that those who were attacking the Africans were writing graffiti describing them as slaves and Negroes. And the leader, Mahmoud Jibril, who is, I guess, top man now amongst the so-called rebel group, he says, well, what's going on there is only the business of the people there, Misrata, not our business, he says.
Well, this is very strange for a man who says he's a legitimate leader and a democratic leader and a responsible leader. This is not a responsible leader. And I tell you from people who know him on a personal basis that he's an elitist, that he doesn't believe all men are born equal. He believes that there should be a ruling class. That's the type of...
Such as himself.
That's the type of man he is. You believe?
Yeah. All right. I think we had a slight break in the phone there. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can. I can hear you all right.
Well, on this theme about the massacre of Africans. By the way, it's not disputed. You know, when media are confronted, like the Globe or the New York Times, they admit that this is going on. But they choose to suppress this story. And it does tie in with the issue of the African Union made an effort. Were you there when President Zuma came to Tripoli?
No, I just left, but I spoke to people who were there. Mm-hmm. Look, the African Union has made efforts, for sure. This has to do with African, pan-African views and pan-African pressure. Their own public has been pressuring them about this. Because Muammar Gaddafi is very popular in Africa. Despite what people make him out to be or say about him, he's an extremely popular leader in Africa. That is undeniable. They mm-hmm. see him as a real pan-African leader and as a hero there. Mm-hmm. So there was pressure on the African Union. But at the same time, the African Union is subjected to pressure from the EU, NATO, the United States, and even the United Nations. The United Nations is basically following the role given to it by the United States and NATO. You know, Ban Ki-moon has been very active against both Libya and Syria. Mm-hmm. He's been doing exactly what the U.S. and the Pentagon have asked him to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, and his role in Cote d'Ivoire was hardly noble.
No, this is not a noble man.
Incredible. And that brings up another name I have to ask you about, Mr. Ocampo. Ocampo, has, of the International Criminal Court, is working energetically trying to make a criminal case against Colonel Gaddafi and his family and close associates. But meanwhile, all these crimes are laying there in front of him. NATO crimes and genocidal attacks on Africans.
Listen, Ocampo himself has a bad track record. If you look at his personal biography and history, the ICC, I believe, paid somebody to stop a complaint, a rape complaint against
him. Yes.
The ICC paid the International Criminal Court as an international institution, paid somebody to stop legal action against him. This is a man who's has a political agenda. He hasn't done anything in regards to the other cases of the ICC. From 2007, there's a pending case in from Afghanistan, the Russo-Georgian War over South Ossetia and the Caucasus, mm-hmm. and the former Soviet space. It's still pending. So many cases are pending. But when it comes to Libya, within weeks, he jumps to conclusions. And what is his evidence? Media reports. And, an example I want to make is one of the media reports is Gaddafi wants to open up a Russian base in Libya. I don't know what type of evidence this is. I've looked at the annex of the evidence, and I actually, to a degree, played a minute role in helping with the ICC case by reviewing this media evidence. So I know very well that the ICC's case is based on nothing. It's based on media reports, most of which have been falsified, because Al Jazeera, Al Arabiya, the BBC are not credible at all.
By the way, how could it? It just seems incredible, doesn't it, that here you have the United Nations creates this shiny thing called the ICC, and its top man makes accusations based on something he read in a newspaper.
Well, the top man.
I mean, by the way, he wasn't reading you. If he'd read you, he wouldn't have made that accusation. But he doesn't seem to know how to read a newspaper.
There's a reason why he's the head of the ICC. He was picked because they know he'll do exactly what they want. And I'm speaking about the United States, the State Department, President Obama. I'm talking about the leaders of NATO, the British Prime Minister, and the British government. They all pick people they know will play ball and demonize and go after the people they target. And mm-hmm. they targeted Muammar Gaddafi and his family, just like they targeted Saddam Hussein. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying any of these people were ideal leaders whatsoever, but I am saying that they're victims in all this, along with their people and their countries.
Well, it could have, of course. I mean, you have Blair and Bush both now stand naked before the world as liars and who created tens of thousands of dead Iraqis. Nobody accuses them of anything.
Thousands. It's a million. It's a million Iraqis. You know, there's different figures on that. And
yes.
A million is a conservative figure now. How many children died because of these UN Security Council? The sanctions before that Madeleine Albright said was worth it.
500,000 worth it, she said. Yes.
Yes. Add that to how many people died after the occupation. You know, Iraq was basically a constant state of war until the Anglo-American occupation. Till this day, there's no peace in that country. Mm-hmm. Did Al-Qaeda exist in Iraq before this, what we call Al-Qaeda? No. Did it exist in Libya really before this or in Tripoli? No, not the way it had. they have proliferated terrorism around the world. They have spread hatred around the world. They have destabilized. Libya's living standards won't go up, just like how Iraq's never haven't gone up since that war. You know, Iraq's living standards went up after the Iran-Iraq war, which was 8 years, but they didn't go up after the Gulf War or after the 2003 Anglo-American invasion, which was illegal, too. They didn't go up at all. Mm-hmm. This says something a lot about these wars. They really do target civilians. In Libya, they targeted civilians. There's no question about it. They brought...
Go ahead.
Let me say this. They brought the people they call terrorists into Libya. They brought them. They controlled them. And I spoke to people on the Transitional Council side, and they said that the United States has brought the extremists in, and they ordered the extremists, and they control the extremists.
Yeah. By the way, you heard that from some people serving under this council, right?
Yes. It's from the rebel side. I heard that. Of course, yeah. They don't want them there. Look, everybody on the rebel side is not bad, okay? Some people were there for misconstrued reasons. Some people are there for their own greed, but they still want sovereignty in Libya. And a lot of people are puppets, and a lot of people are lost. Mm-hmm. They're just fighting because of family members there or because of patriarchy and some allegiance to somebody. And the majority of their fighters are non-Libyan. They don't originate from Libya. They're from outside, okay? Yeah. And the Transitional Council, a lot of the Libyans on that Transitional Council are Libyans who lived outside of the country. Just like there's a Transitional Council now for Syria, and most of the Transitional Council members for the Syrian one, none of them lived in Syria. They're all from outside of Syria. So there's no activists from on the ground in Syria Council in Syria.
That's one of the other aspects of this. It's shocking. I've spoken to a couple of people knowledgeable on this show, knowledgeable about the Saudis and the Gulf monarchies who played a big role here, and they pointed out that a couple of the Syrian so-called leaders abroad are actually Saudis. They carry more than one passport.
Yes, you're right.
So you not only have followers that are mercenaries, you have leaders who apparently are mercenaries.
Well, these are leaders for hire, in a way. They're assigned leaders. You can call them assigned leaders. For example, two main leaders in the Transitional Council of Libya, they're both foreign taught. They've lived abroad. They haven't lived in Libya. One of them is Mahmoud Jibril, who served the Gulf monarchs for a very long time and helped them with their PR. The other one is Ali Tarhouni. He's the oil and finance minister, mm-hmm. and he was in every single meeting about regime change in Libya since 1990, okay? And the U.S. put him there. He's Washington's man in Tripoli. And the first thing he did as the oil and finance minister of Libya was sign a paper saying to privatize all the oil and financial assets of that country. He sold the country by signing that agreement. That's the first thing he did, and he's Washington's man in Tripoli.
Sounds like a good investment from Washington's point of view.
Yeah, he's a great investment / agent, for sure.
This is Mahdi Nazim Royal. By the way, we're very grateful for all the time you're giving us, and we have a couple more matters I want to make sure we touch on. Also, Nazim, pardon me, I keep calling you Nazim. It's Mahdi Nazim Royal and globalresearch.ca. As a journalist, you were, of course, there July, August. What was the role of the so-called new springtime states, Tunisia and Egypt? I kept wondering when this so-called rebellion was going on in Benghazi, they were getting weapons. And if you don't want a civil war to become worse, you're supposed to prevent weapons for either side. But I got the impression that weapons were coming across the border.
They overtly and covertly supported the war. They overtly and covertly worked against the Libyan government. When one of Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Arab, was killed, the Egyptians sent a delegation. I told people in Libya, I said, if I was the Libyan government, I wouldn't let them in because they're part of this war. The Egyptians actually snuck in with the Algerian delegation because I'm pretty sure they knew that the Libyans wouldn't let that Egyptian military junta's delegation to come in. The Egyptian military actively helped the United States. It sent weapons and fighters from the eastern border, the Libyan-Egyptian frontier. It sent them into Benghazi. The Tunisians supported the sanctions. Special forces were entering for both countries. Hillary Clinton and the U.S. made agreements with both, as did several Western European countries, including Italy. In fact, on my way out from the Libyan Arab Jamhuriya to the island state of Malta, south of Tripoli in the Mediterranean Sea, I was on a ship with three freed Italians. They were either special forces or mercenaries who were caught and captured, I believe, in the month of February or March. They were captured by the Libyan security or Libyan military, and they were held prisoner. They were freed, and they were there on the ground fighting. So, and they used the Tunisian border to come into Libya. They had no passports either. They claimed, it was claimed by the Italian government and others, that they were tourists who had accidentally crossed the border. It happens a lot, actually, and it's always untrue.
They were probably hiking.
Yes, exactly.
There's a lot of careless hikers in this world.
Yes. Sometimes they stumble from Iraq into Iran, sometimes from Iraq into Syria, sometimes from Colombia into Venezuela. Anyways, the point is that they said they're hikers and they carried no passports. They had no passports.
No passports.
I don't know what type of tourists don't carry passports, especially in that part of the world, in North Africa. You know? And they had military equipment. They had rucksacks. They had everything. They had the camouflage. Patterns. Two of them were very well built. You could tell that these are, look, I'm ex-Canadian military myself. I was in the Canadian Armed Forces. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that I know somebody else who comes from that background when I see them.
Yes, I agree with you. by the way, that's a heck of a story. There's been a lot of this activity. There almost seems to be a gentleman's agreement in the mainstream not to talk about these guys. But we recall there was a special forces guys picked up in Benghazi, and that was an odd sort of photo op opportunity. But there was there have been others. But it's an understated. It obviously should be near the top of the agenda of people to comprehend what's going on. And Mahdi, I want to ask you about Tunisia. And if you know about Egypt. How did they account for their own conduct toward the Libyan crisis as it was unfolding? Did they acknowledge, for example, that they were helping the armed move against Gaddafi?
They try to keep it from the public. To a level, they did. Sometimes they tried not to. Let me tell you, the Tunisian population was against the war, at least the ones I saw, and I was in Tunisia. Mm-hmm. Before I went into Libya, I spent time in Tunisia. I was in both Tunis and I spent more and in Djerba on the border. Djerba's on the Mediterranean coast. And I can tell you that a lot of the Tunisians were against the war. And in Djerba, at one of the ports, the Tunisian population, the civilians, were preventing military hardware from being unloaded from a boat. The military hardware was from Qatar, the Gulf state of Qatar, which was intended to be used against Libya.
That'd be the absolute monarchy of Qatar.
Yes.
Which is the greatest friend of democracy, apparently, in the whole Middle East.
I don't understand how these undemocratic regimes in the Persian Gulf, these Arab petro-sheikdom, they're the antithesis or antithesis of democracy. It's a crazy irony. It's Orwellian to say these countries are fighting for democracy when they don't allow democracy in their own countries. And it exposes the hypocrisy of the Harper government, mm-hmm. of the Obama government, and of the British and French and Italian governments in this whole military adventure against the Libyan people.
Yeah, none of them are giving the slightest problem to the Saudi family. It's not even, you know, it's just a royal family, and they run the place. If you're a monarch in this great Arab Spring, you don't have to worry about a thing. I mean, it's certainly not from NATO.
Yeah, there's an actual rule. It's not in stone, but it's a rule you can conceptualize with. This rule is that if it's an Arab monarchy, they won't be criticized. But if they're an Arab republic, they will be criticized. And for a while, Yemen was the only exception to this rule. But now it's been receiving some criticism. Mm-hmm. But the monarchies for sure are being left unscathed, untouched. And you know, since we're talking about Saudi Arabia. This is a government where the country's bank account is one and the same. The bank account of the Saudi Arabia is one and the same with the royal family. There's no independent government bank account. They run the country's banking
is one of the personal accounts of the Saudi royal family.
Congratulate them for efficiency. They're not wasting any time or money, you know, passing it through a third party's hands. That would just be a waste.
It destroys it.
By the way,
Madi,
you may have actually uncovered for us a mystery to Canadians of why the Queen's photo is going up all over the country. It may be that it's an insurance policy. You can't touch us. We're a monarchy.
Madi, I read an article saying that the monarchies in Europe and the Arab world are united by the fact that they're monarchies, so you might be onto something.
You're quite right. They did invite King of Bahrain attended the royal, it was.
They invited the Crown Prince of Bahrain to come there, but the Al Khalifa Prince, that's the name of the royal family in Bahrain, did not come because he was busy. That was the excuse that was given.
He had citizens to kill.
Controversy, but he was still invited, and I know that a lot of criminals were invited to that wedding.
Madeda, lastly, I want to ask you clearly, and there's a crisis unfolding in Syria, and I think I saw in Global Research an article pointing out that this same model of recruitment of so-called jihadist armed groups, very well trained, by the way, we should point out, they're not very sloppy. Some of these guys have been at it for a while, are being directed now at Syria with the view of destabilizing and bringing down the Syrian government with the cooperation of Turkey. That's a big old question, but I'd just like your thoughts about what you think is unfolding there.
Well, the Turks have definitely worked against the Libyans, the Syrians, and even the Palestinians and the Lebanese. They are part of NATO. They've always been a part of NATO. They're Israel's closest regional allies in Southwest Asia, or the area also known as the Middle East, which is a little broader than Southwest Asia. They have never cut any of their military, industrial, or economic ties with Israel. They are deeply tied to the United States. They have very close collaboration with German and Israeli and American intelligence. They, in fact, are the ones who connected the CIA and MI6 with a lot of the Libyan traders on the ground, people who worked for money, basically, and it was the Turks that did this. The Turks helped them out a lot. The Turks also see themselves as creating a sphere of influence in Syria and even militarily intervening. The Turks have made it clear that they don't consider the problems in Syria a domestic issue. They see it as a regional and international issue, and they basically are saying they have the right to militarily intervene, just like they have in northern Iraq against the Kurds. And it's very ironic that the Kurds say this. They're saying this about Syria, but the Turkish government is absolutely hypocritical because they are doing the same thing in southeastern Turkey, which is referred to as Kurdistan. They are doing the same thing with their military, and there's martial law in parts of those places. And this is a country that up to a few years ago outlawed the Kurdish language from being spoken and forced those people to call themselves Mountain Turks and actually tried to destroy the Kurd culture there. You know, so the Turkish government's playing with fire here. Its relationship with Iran is also becoming very negative because of what's happening in Syria. So what the Turks have been doing is that the Turkish government, not the Turkish people. The Turkish people are a whole different matter. They're very genuine, and they're very respectful people. But the Turkish government here has been helping the U.S., and they're also allowing NATO now to transfer ground troops to Turkey. A base in Turkey is being turned into a base for NATO ground troops, which can potentially be used against Armenia, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Russia, and Russia's allies in the former Soviet Union. So this is a very dangerous step that's being taken towards in that region. It'll destabilize an entire region in southeastern Europe to southwest Asia and the Caucasus. In regards to Saudi Arabia, they're also funding money there. Money's been going through Lebanon as well, through Saudi and U.S. and French proxies who have ties to the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood, Hezb Tahrir, have been co-opted, I'm sorry to say, but that is the truth. I'm not saying all the individuals in that party are bad, but the leadership there are based in London, and they are working against the Syrian government, and they are a minority, an ideological minority. You know, the Syrian government's made mistakes. I've never called it a democracy, but the truth is that it is also being victimized. The military there has made some harsh moves, they've acted out of line in some positions, in some instances. But the fact is they're being attacked by gunmen, and there are snipers who are firing on the Syrian forces and on the civilians.
Yes.
To ignite hatred, to ignite fuel, and to balkanize and divide that country. And they've actually been attacking very strategic port, energy, economic, and oil areas on the border of Iraq and on the Mediterranean coast, and that is very deliberate. They're doing that, and that's also tied in tandem with the sanctions, the U.S. and EU, the unilateral sanctions they've placed on Syria, because they want to economically weaken Syria so the government will not be able to continue its social program, and that everything will spiral and become even worse.
Yeah.
You know, the situation in Syria looks very bad, to be honest.
Yes. It is. It's very menacing. Thank goodness we have globalresearch.ca and yourself, Mahdi Nazimroya, reporting on this. And I hope we can talk to you again soon about this crisis as it is unfolding, because the information you are providing is not heard very widely enough.
Well, thank you for having me, and there might be a possibility that we might talk, and I might be talking to you from Damascus in the future.
Ah, we look forward to that. Mahdi, again, congratulations on your bravery and your work, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Mahdi Nazimroya, globalresearch.ca, and very thorough, and he is very brave. I remember thinking as the the National Transition Council was entering Tripoli, and they were pretty bloody-minded, and I was thinking, Mahdi is in that hotel, and I crossed my fingers, because that was very dicey. I think we'll take a brief break, and we'll come back, and Phil will tell us about the movies.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Ever thought about studying in another country? Perhaps you are looking for an opportunity to work abroad or volunteer or just travel and see the world. Come and find out more about how you can make your dreams a reality at the 2011 Study and Go Abroad Fair. Taking place at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre on October 1st and 2nd, entry is free to all. Meet with some of the top universities from all over the world and visit our travel pavilion to plan your adventure travel, volunteer work, language travel, and internship. That's 1 to 6 p.m. on October 1st and 2nd at the Metro Toronto Convention Centre. Free admission. More information is available at studyandgoabroad.com.
And you're back. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. And we're going to talk about the International Film Festival. But I want to make sure I mention that we are, like everybody else, sort of today watching the clock. There has been a meeting is going on. It may be ending now. Of the final review board in the state of Georgia to decide the fate of Troy Davis. And I invite you, please, go to the website. So all you have to do is type in the name, Troy Davis, and do anything you can. Amnesty International, Harry Belafonte, the Pope, anybody with a sense of decency is trying to save the life of this African-American who is on death row. And if you know, and most of us do, grow up understanding the appetite for capital punishment in some states of the United States, not amongst a broad population so much, but certainly some states, like the state of Texas, is notorious for executing people. And it's been demonstrated time and again, racial bias in every aspect of these cases is easily demonstrated. And, of course, now we know through DNA, et cetera, that there's been hundreds and hundreds of people put to death because people were black, poor, and were convicted after short trials with inadequate defense. And so this is a very important battle, the battle for Troy Davis. Please join in that. And another announcement I want to make sure people are aware of is that the author, Toronto resident and University of Toronto Keith Bullender has a course on Cuba, contemporary Cuba, and it's going to begin on October 25. This is at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies, and the course is going to begin. It'll be held Tuesdays, October 25 until November 29, once a week from 7 to 9 p.m. The course examines Cuban history, paying particular attention to the revolution, the relations between the USA and Cuba, and what is currently taking place in Cuba with economic and social changes. And if you want information on this course, you go to available on the Continuing Studies website at learn.utoronto.ca. That is learn.utoronto.ca, and where you get the more details. But that's Keith Bolander, who is a very brilliant writer who courageously wrote a wonderful book about what has happened to the people of Cuba as a result of organized terrorism against them, about which the U.S. has never said a thing, and indeed harbors people who committed that terrorism, which means there is no war on terrorism per se. There is a war, all right. I hope people will go there and learn more. That's, again, I'll just say it. Learn.utoronto.ca. And now we return to Phil Conlon and the movies. Phil, what did you see? Tell us what, number one, what's the best you saw, and then I guess we'll ask you what the worst.
Well, the best film that I saw is an Italian film called Terra Ferma, which means closed earth. And it was shot on an island in the Mediterranean, Linosa, which is attached to Sicily. The filmmaker is of Sicilian origin. He's he's a worldly man. He's educated in the States. He was born in Rome. But his loyalty is to Sicily, and especially to the fishermen of Sicily, and that's what he likes to make films about. Sicily finds itself today, because of its geography, in the middle of a mass human tragedy that I'm very happy to say, judge on what I saw in this festival, that the artistic community of Europe is really taking notice of, and that is that thousands and thousands of people from African countries are risking their lives, putting themselves in the hands of smugglers, of very untrustworthy people, to get into Europe where they can have the possibility of finding some jobs and earn a wage, right? I don't view these people any different from my European ancestors who came to America, you know, because they wanted to work and because they wanted to be able to feed their
families.
And
light on the forms.
Right.
And,
yes. Yeah, and it didn't necessarily show up with documents and passports either.
Appropriate documents.
But what is going on now is that there are boatloads of boats, by the way, is a generous term. In some cases, these are rafts. These are, you know, barely a couple of sticks of woods put together. Some of these islands in Sicily are very, very close to the African coast, and so they're the obvious target. And the Italian state has responded, as you would expect, a state that belongs to NATO and is run by a guy like Berlusconi would respond, right? They are brutal toward these people, to the point that they have laws in Italy now that makes you a criminal if you are on a boat and you see somebody floating around in the ocean because his raft is breaking up. If you succor that person, which is what human beings do when you see somebody who is about to drown and you're on a very safe vessel, you're supposed to take him onto your vessel and save his life, right? And in this film, Terra Ferma, becomes the clash because, in fact, the drama is about a very stubborn fisherman who, first of all, wants to go out and fish every day. The European Union wants him to sell his license back to them because, of course, there's no room in the modern European community for small fishermen, you know, who sell to a local market. You know, the fish is supposed to be monopolized by, right, you know, by big guys, right, with big factory fish that, you know, fish the oceans
grown
dry.
Grown in Ohio and dropped into the Mediterranean to be caught.
Exactly. But this guy is not playing ball, and he sees people who are calling to help, and he helps them get onto his boat. And his staff warns him, you're going to get in trouble. And indeed he does. What I love about this this filmmaker is that he portrays the Italian police for the absolute thugs that they are. They just show up and the next day and they just confiscate his boat. And he says, well, this is my livelihood. And they said, well, you should have thought about that when you helped people out of the ocean, right? And it turned out that one of the actors used in it in this film is an amateur. She is a woman who herself is a survivor of one of these boats, and she depicted the story. It's a very, very touching story, and I think the most wonderful moment in it is when this the character who is the father says, "You know, I learned the law of the sea from my father and my grandfather, and the law of the sea is that you help somebody at sea who's in distress." And the law of Italy doesn't have the right to cancel that. And it's just a wonderful moment. And I'm happy to say that there were at least two other films that I saw that I'm aware of which dealt with this very, very same subject. In one case, another Italian film with a very, very senior film director, Ermanno Olmi, who's been around for 50 years, in which he depicts a old, broken-down priest whose church has been taken away from him because there's nobody going to church anymore. And who is asked to give sanctuary. Well, not asked. They just show up, right? And the state shows up and says, you've got some Africans in there. And the priest preaches the best of the gospel and said, how dare you turn on the poor and the vulnerable and those who come to seek help, right? Of course, the cops are very unimpressed, and they do turn on them. That's called the Cardboard Village. And I said, a very, very senior director. At the other end of the spectrum was a very young German woman who is making just her second film, which she set in the Canary Islands. And again, the theme is some African migrants who reach land, but that doesn't really solve their problem because they're going to get thrown into concentration camps. And the very, very interesting thing that comes up in this is that if you are from certain countries in Africa, they will let you go into a transit camp and stuff like that. But if you're from Senegal, they're going to send you right back, right? And of course, I'm interested in the fact that they have that policy towards Senegal because Senegal is a country that the World Bank and the IMF and all the Americans managed to impose one of their own as the president. So now that, of course, one of their guys is the president, well, that country can't possibly produce a refugee, either an economic or a political refugee. So therefore,
because he's a marvelous guy.
Because the president's a marvelous guy who used to work for the World Bank, right? Which I think he literally did, by the way.
Well, there's all down the western coast of Africa, you'll find former World Bank employees who are now prime ministers and presidents.
But I was really, really impressed and thrilled to see that the filmmaking community in Europe wants to deal with this issue and wants to force people's attention to it. And I salute the festival for bringing these films to our attention.
Oh, right? Absolutely. And thank you for that. By the way, this is a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We have a website, Taylor-Report. And so now I'm going to ask Phil, can you post on our website the names of the films that you just told us about?
I certainly will.
And if possible, how people can trace them, because I have a funny feeling we're not going to be seeing a lot of them.
Well, I don't expect the local distributors to be putting them in the mainstream movie theaters. I mean, these are films that people are going to have to look for to find. And that's one of the tragedies, is that so many of these fine films are made, are seen here in the festival, but the distributors, who, of course, are a monopoly also, right, choose not to distribute them. And they say, well, we're giving the people what they want. But the people are told by Hollywood it is you want. And you know.
If we want your opinion, we will tell you.
Yeah, exactly.
This is Phil Connor talking, and he's promising that if you go to Taylor-Report.com in the next couple of days, he will have posted the names of these outstanding films, and maybe we can agitate somehow so that we can all see them, or just how to manage to see it, because they sound like wonderful films. I shouldn't go from plus to minus, but I guess I have to. What was the worst film you saw?
Well, I guess the biggest disappointment, especially because it is going to be given a major Hollywood release, is that it was a film called Winnie, which is a biopic of Winnie Mandela, and I like to call it Apartheid for Dummies. For people who might not remember the apartheid
regime. Maybe it's racism for dummies.
A little bit of that, too.
I mean, it doesn't really... Yeah. I think you'd say it fails, actually.
Absolutely.
Apartheid.
What it does is it manages to pretty up the struggle against apartheid. There was a couple of bad people. According to this film, they were all policemen. There was no government or infrastructure behind it. It was just a bunch of nasty cops who pushed around a few black people. But this very noble man, Nelson Mandela, was a good friend of America and Britain. He was noble, and he had this wife, and she was noble for a while, but then somehow she lost her nobility. She lost her nobility, right? So, it's a caricature of Winnie Mandela. It's a caricature of the struggle against apartheid. Of course, they had to use American actors. There can't possibly be an actor in all of Africa who could play Nelson Mandela, Mandela, right?
Can I just add to your review that saying this, that I knew slightly, and corresponded with Fatima Mir, who was the first biographer, the authorized biographer of Mandela. And Fatima Mir died last year, a brilliant woman, outstanding ANC fighter. She was close to Winnie and a supporter of Winnie to her dying day.
Well, if you saw this movie and that was all you knew about South Africa, you would not know there was an Asian community in South Africa or that they had any role in the struggle against apartheid. You know, I mean, that's just too sophisticated for what Hollywood thinks the proper audience is. You know, so, I mean, it's a lost opportunity and very disappointing that, a woman who should be given serious attention in the building of an artistic portrayal of her life would be done by this. I do want to say that there was one section of the movie which is better. She underwent a horrific period in her life when she was kept in solitary confinement for 8 months. And I will give the filmmakers credit that they depicted that period of her life very, very well. And I think, in fact, they ought to just take that section of the film and just make that. That's your film. You know, this is what this woman endured for 8 months, and how she withstood the sadism and the torture of the apartheid authorities, who eventually gave up, and they said we cannot break her spirit. But we don't see in the film just how extraordinary a woman Winnie Mandela is, that they did not break her, because I could say what they depicted there, if that is accurate, and I have no reason to doubt that it is. That 99% of people, if not more, would have been broken by what they did to her, and she wasn't.
No, it wasn't and isn't an extremely tough individual. Yeah. We're coming to the end. This is you've been listening here to the Taylor Report. I want to remind you, Keith Bolander is offering this course on about Cuba, and Keith is a great opportunity. Go to learn.utoronto.ca, and also. Let's fight for Troy Davis. I hope the news is good, but we, as of this hour, we still don't know what they're deciding. And again, it's a Taylor Report. We hope you will be with us next week.